Hey there, and welcome to this week's episode of Lost Origins, your number one radio show for all things ancient mystery, alternative historical theories, and lost civilizations. Check us out online at lost-origins.com and sign up for our free newsletter. We're going to be rolling out contests, merchandise, and perks to anyone who signs up for updates, so make sure that you get in on that. You can also connect with us on several social media platforms, those being Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Hit that subscribe button, you guys, and make sure that you never miss an episode or an article from your friends at Lost Origins. This week's episode is brought to you by Inner Traditions and Baron Company. Inner Traditions has been publishing books on esoteric philosophy, New Age spirituality, and alternative health for well over 40 years. Visit innertraditions.com to learn more about their books and authors and sign up for catalogs, coupons, and special offers. We've really enjoyed working with them here at Lost Origins, and we highly recommend that you pick up any one of their books. You will not be disappointed. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have a very special treat for you on this week's show. This week, we're going to be talking with author and researcher Scott Crichton. Scott has authored two incredible books, those being The Giza Prophecy and The Secret Chamber of Osiris. Scott's research is compelling, and it challenges the orthodox views of Egyptology as to the purpose of the pyramids, their age, and how they were built. So today we're going to be discussing his research, his pyramidal theories, and much more right after the break. Hey there, folks, and we are back. We have a very, very special guest for you today. Today, we are fortunate enough to be joined by author and researcher Scott Crichton. Scott is an engineer whose extensive travels have allowed him to explore many of the world's ancient sites, including the Giza Plateau. In his latest book, The Secret Chamber of Osiris, Scott presents very compelling evidence with regards to how Egyptology has crossed their wires in terms of Egyptian history. The Secret Chamber of Osiris is also our March read of the month. So everybody, I highly recommend that you pick up this book. You will not be disappointed. This thing was a page turner. I went through this book so fast, and then I continue going back to it just to really absorb these theories and concepts that Scott puts forth in this work. So today we're going to be discussing his work, his theories surrounding the true history of Egypt. And it is my pleasure to welcome all the way from Scotland, Scott Crichton. Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello, Andrew. It's a real pleasure to be here.
We really appreciate you taking the time. I know that the time difference is a little challenging between Denver and Scotland, but we really appreciate you making time for us here at Lost Origins. So before we start talking about your latest book, Scott, which congratulations on being the read of the month, I think it may be beneficial for our listeners who aren't very familiar with your work to get a bit of background on who you are and how you got involved with all things ancient mystery.
Okay. Well, Andrea, obviously, as you stated earlier in your brief introduction, I'm from Scotland. I'm born and bred here in Scotland, and I've lived here all of my life. I'm now 52 years of age, and I've been involved or interested in Egypt and all things Egyptian or ancient Egyptian since I was a small child, really. When I was at school, I'm sure your listeners will probably know what I'm talking about. That's, you know, your first introduction to ancient Egyptian history is when you're in primary school, or I think you maybe call it junior school or junior high school in the States.
Right.
And that's where it started for me. I think I must have been about 7 years old, and I was just absolutely blown away by that ancient kingdom, even as a young kid.
Right.
It was just mind-blowing to me that you could have these massive, massive structures, these gigantic pyramids made of gigantuan stones. How did they move these things? How did they construct these things? Why did they build this thing for just one guy?
Right.
I mean, it was just mind-blowing for me as a seven-year-old kid, and that thought has never gone away from me, has never gone away from me. But I think really, you know, my career intervened. I'm an IT engineer, much like yourself, Andrew. Mm-hmm. Although I'm more involved in computer network design and interconnectivity. I worked for a couple of large international firms and spent a lot of my time, my career, traveling the world, right. Which was great because as an IT engineer traveling the world, it allowed me to get to see all these sites free of charge, which was great. I went all over the Far East, the Middle East, Europe, even the United States, travelled all over the world, looking at many of the world's ancient sites. But obviously my passion, my absolute passion, is ancient Egypt. And I think part of that passion, it comes from something I think that's deep-rooted in all of us, and that is, who are we? And where did we really come from?
Right.
Is our history correct? You know, is there more to what we've been told? Have they missed something? You know, have the historians, the archaeologists, the Egyptologists, have they missed something? You know, have they got the complete picture? Because when I look at these structures, Andrew, I see things which just are not explained in the academic textbooks. The answers just aren't there. And that's, again, another big part of who I am. I need answers. I'm one of these people that, you know, if I see a puzzle or a question, I've got to get an answer.
Right.
You know, and that's what Egypt, or ancient Egypt, is for me. It's a big, big, gigantic puzzle, and I was fascinated with it. So after I finished. I didn't finish my career. I'm now self-employed. I own some IT internet cafes here in Scotland, and that allows me to have the time and the funds to do my research and my writing. And so, about 13 years ago, I really thought, now I've got to get into this more. I've got to see what this is all about. I've got to get answers to these questions. Mm. And that's what I did 13 years ago. I took my savings, invested it in this business, and that gave me the time and the wherewithal to pursue my dream, my ambition to get these questions answered as best I could, and to a level where I felt I was satisfied, rather than just being giving, you know, the standard mantra, the standard dogma from the academic books, where, you know, they just, at the end of the day, leave more answers than questions.
Right. Well, and you mentioned, a lot of these questions are not answered. And I find it so unfortunate that not only are they not answered, but many times it seems like the evidence is blatantly ignored. And that's just mind-boggling to me, because I'm much like yourself. I have a curious personality. I need to know, the exact same questions that you're asking. I need those answers as well. And it's very frustrating when we have very compelling evidence staring us in the face the world over, and archaeologists and scholars and academia just continue to subscribe to the uniformitarian view of, we understand what happened definitively, and we're not open to reevaluating that. And you also mentioned that you look at these structures in Egypt and you wonder, how could they be built for just one guy? And I've always thought the same thing. And I think that's why I related to your book so well, because you open Secret Chamber of Osiris by exploring the possibility of the Great Pyramids being built not as tombs, but as arcs. Can you speak a little bit to that for our listeners, Scott?
Absolutely. Well, the thing is, Andrew, this idea of the pyramids as arcs, it actually isn't a new idea. It's not a new idea at all. And I openly admit this is not an idea that is unique to Scott Crichton. It just isn't. It's an idea that has been around for a very, very, very long time. In fact, we don't even know, Andrew, we don't even know really where that idea originated. Yes, we've got the medieval papers and writings of the Arab chroniclers, Al-Masudi and people like that, that have basically told us that the ancient Egyptian king Saurid learned from his astronomer priests that a calamity was about to befall the kingdom. Well, not immediately. They said it would occur in 300 years' orbit of the sun.
Right.
And so the king, King Saurid, informed the people that what he would do would build, he would build pyramids all over the kingdom. And what he would put in these pyramids was everything that the kingdom would need to essentially reboot itself after the worst effects of this catastrophe had come to pass.
Right.
What he was told by his astronomer priests is that, I think the head priest was a chap named Aclimon. He told Saurid that there would first be a terrible flood which would drown the entire kingdom. And that would be followed by a terrible fire or drought, mm-hmm. which would also have devastating effects. And so King Saurid said, well, this is what we are going to do. Just as I said there, we are going to build these pyramids and we are going to store in them everything that the kingdom will need to reconstitute itself, to rebirth itself. You know, so they would be placing things like all types of seed, all manner of tools. They would perhaps even put in weapons in these things. They would place within these pyramid arcs civilizing knowledge, their knowledge maybe written on papyri or whatever, mm-hmm. would all be placed within these structures, and possibly texts even written on the outsides of these structures, because it was all about preservation of the physical, you know, and the spiritual. You know, they had to ensure that their kingdom could be reborn. That would require knowledge, but it would also require practical things like tools and seed types and all other, for example, under the Step Pyramid at Saqqara. Now, not a lot of people are aware of this, but under the Step Pyramid at Saqqara, now this is the very first pyramid that the ancient Egyptians built. It was the first gigantic structure of its kind anywhere in the world at any point in history, the Step Pyramid at Saqqara. Now, when the early Egyptologist, a chap called Forth, investigated this pyramid in the early 1900s, he found below it there are galleries and passageways that are literally kilometres, you know, between all these different passageways are kilometres in length, wow. several kilometres in length. And he was walking through these passages up to shins in seeds and grain, all through these passages. Also, they found in the chambers underneath this pyramid, they found something like 40,000 distribution vessels. We are talking pots, vases, cups, you know, all manner, bowls, you know, all manner of distribution storage vessels underneath this pyramid.
Wow.
Now, this is the kind of thing we were talking about earlier, Andrew, that the Orthodox Egyptology ignore. They just gloss over it. Oh, well, that's there, but it doesn't really mean very much. It's just that's just the goods for the king's afterlife.
Right.
Well, I'm sorry, but I don't subscribe to that view at all, because the king's afterlife, what they would do is they would have a priestly cult who would come each morning to the cult pyramid at, or the chapel that were supposedly, according to the Orthodox version, and lay a small offering, you know, food and wine or water each morning for the king's sustenance. So why is this? Why would they do that? And then, you know, they would also place, you know, tons and tons and tons of seed underneath these pyramids and thousands of distribution vessels. You know, you only really need small symbolic amounts for the afterlife, because the thing the ancient Egyptians also believed is that if you just painted like a goose or a sheath of corn on the wall of your chapel or your tomb, your mastaba tomb, you know, you could magic these into the real thing in the afterlife. They didn't need the real thing.
Right.
You know, so to find the real thing in such vast quantities underneath this pyramid and all these tens of thousands of storage distribution vessels, they're also, you know, that's a big clue there, right there, Andrew, to what these things were really built for. You know, we don't find bodies in them. Well, they did find a foot. I have to say, they did find a mummified foot mm-hmm. in the Step Pyramid. But it was later found to have been an intrusive burial. It was dated to something like 1650 BC, and the Step Pyramid was built about 2700 BC. So you're talking about 1,000 years later.
Right.
This mummified foot was placed in there, according to to Orthodoxy. So, you know, we have never found a king's body in any of these first 16. Now, I concentrate mainly on the first 16 pyramids that the ancient Egyptians built, Andrew, and I do that for a very specific reason, which we'll probably touch on later. Mm-hmm. But just to say that, you know, there's also evidence of a storage, a massive grain storage facility within the Great Pyramid. Again, you know, this isn't something which is widely known. But what you find in the Great Pyramid is that in 1837, when the antiquarian pyramid investigator, the English Colonel Howard Vyse, when he first opened the hidden chambers above Davidson's chamber, which is above the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, when he first went in there, he found this black powder all over the floor of each of the four chambers which he opened. And it was perfectly still, perfectly evenly spread throughout the chamber, evenly laid out across each of the floors of these chambers. And he didn't know what this black powder was. I explain in the Secret Chamber of Osiris, my book, that there's also damage within the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. It's almost as if there was an explosion at some point. I think it's the author Stephen Mellor that goes into this quite well, and he gives an awful lot of good detail about this. But you can also read about it in Flinders Petrie's work, which is freely available on the internet. There's the blocks, the walls, the granite blocks in the King's Chamber, it's almost as if they've been pushed outwards and slightly upwards. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not where they should be. There's also cracks in the roof of the King's Chamber, which was filled in, and we know it's ancient, with ancient plaster. You know, so there was some explosion or something, and according to, I think it's Stephen Mellor, the there are burn or scorch marks within the King's Chamber. So there's all this evidence that, again, it gets ignored. It's just ignored. And it's like, no, we've got to stop ignoring these things and got to start coming up with answers for these things, cohesive answers to these things that make sense. Now, I don't know if I'm right. I could very well be wrong. But it seems to me that what would cause such catastrophic damage within the King's Chamber and also explain black dust that's filtered up above the King's Chamber into these other small chambers that had been hidden until 1837. How can we explain both of those events, mm-hmm. both of pieces of evidence rationally? And it seems to me a grain dust explosion would explain that perfectly. Mm-hmm. This was a massive... If the Grand Gallery, for example, stored massive amounts of grain and they were either storing it or removing it, who knows, a cloud of grain dust could have gone up and someone walks in with a torch, boom.
Yeah.
You know, these things are catastrophic. You've probably seen images of them on the news, these grain bins, you know, the damage of grain dust exploding. It's like a bomb.
Well, you know, I grew up in the Midwest, and I was in a rural area, and we had one of the largest granaries within the region. The exact same thing happened, and it exploded in the middle of the night, and I was miles away and still heard it and felt it in the house. It made national news, and this is, you know, 20 years ago, but it is a tremendous power that can occur from one of these granaries exploding. So I thought that when I read this in your book, I thought, like, this makes so much sense. I just found that concept so fascinating.
Now, what I'm talking about here, Andrew, when I say, you know, they were building them as arcs. Now, I'm not talking about the type of thing. You probably heard the Ben Carson stuff on the news about...
Oh, sure.
You know, Joseph's granaries and all that. And there's been some discussion about my work on the internet in connection with Ben Carson stuff. There are completely different ideas we're talking about here. You know, I'm not talking about granaries. I'm not, because an ancient Egyptian granary was meant to be opened and accessible. What I'm talking about with these pyramids as recovery vaults, they weren't just seed vaults, they had other things in them as well, and they were meant to be sealed repositories, not granaries which are easily accessible. These are arcs that are meant, built to withstand some catastrophic event, some massive global flood event, and they were built so big and so strong that they could not be washed away, and they would hold within them the seed to restart life again, restart the ancient Egyptian civilization. It wasn't about... And by the way, that's probably why, Andrew, you find all these boat pits. You know, the Great Pyramid, just around the Great Pyramid, there are about 7 boat pits for giant boats. Not just one. You know, the Orthodox, dogma tells us that, oh, well, the king needed this boat, this solar bark to, you know, sail off, you know, round the Duat, through the Duat, and, you know, his solar bark through the Duat, and then, you know, across the sun, following the sun across the heavens. Why did he need 7 of them?
Right.
You know, it's this kind of thing which annoys me. I'm saying, come on, get real here. Why did he need 7 of them? You know, it's all this kind of stuff. So anyway, back to this arc idea. We're not talking here, Andrew, about, you know, feeding the entire population of Egypt from these, because the chambers within them, yeah, we know the chambers in them are fairly small, but, you know, they built several of them. They built at least 16 of these things right along the banks of the Nile. And, you know, we're not doing anything any different, really, from what the ancient Egyptians did, because our own civilization, Andrew, I think it was in 2008, opened the Svalbard Global Seed Vault in Svalbard, and in the Arctic Circle. It's part of Norway.
Right.
And we have placed in the Svalbard Global Seed Vault every single seed there is virtually in the world, seed type in the world, in these sealed containers, thousands and thousands of sealed containers. And if you look at a diagram of the inner, you know, chambers of the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, honestly, Andrew, you'd swear you were looking at the inside of the Great Pyramid, the channels and passageways in the chambers.
Right.
They're not virtually identical, but my goodness, they are really, really similar. You know, so the Svalbard Global Seed Vault is not there to, you know, feed the entire population of the Earth if something catastrophic happens to the Earth. That's not what the Svalbard Global Seed Vault is about. It's about, you know, if a particular population or genus of plant or whatever dies out in the earth, we've got a backup, we've got a safety mechanism to replant and you know, reconstitute and continue that particular species of plant or whatever. You know, so that's what it's about. It's about reseeding, not about refeeding the entire population. It's about, you know, starting again.
Right.
And that's what these ancient Egyptians, in my opinion, were trying to do. And that, as I said right at the beginning of this small discussion, was what the ancient Arab text tell us was the function of the first pyramids. They were built to contain everything that would allow the kingdom to reconstitute itself. We don't know where the Arab chroniclers got their information, but it must at some time have been passed down orally for goodness knows how many generations, tens of thousands of years in my estimation, eventually was written down and passed down. And obviously these things will become corrupted over time, embellished over time,
sure,
appropriated for political purposes over time. You know, all sorts of things would cause the general story to change. But I think, and there's no pun intended here, Andrew, there is a grain of truth in
right,
some of these stories.
I would agree with you. I mean, you know, there is a mechanism that exists that as a story, you know, rooted in fact, is passed from generation to generation. It is embellished. That was well said. It reminds me much of, you know, playing the game telephone as a child, where somebody thinks of a sentence or a phrase and then whispers it to somebody in the circle, and then it keeps going around from person to person. Mm-hmm. And by the time it comes back to the originator, it still may hold a similar message or the same message, but because of information being lost in translation, it's a little bit different, right? And I think that may be what we are seeing here. You did mention that your work focuses on the first 16 pyramids along the Nile. Yes. And I found your theory of the intentional layout of these 16 pyramids and their relation to Osiris to be just mind-blowing. Can you kind of walk our listeners through that concept, that theory, and that correlation between the first 16 pyramids, their connection to Osiris, and maybe about how you arrived at that conclusion?
Okay. Well, what your listeners have to keep in mind here, Andrew, is that Osiris was one of the foremost, if not the most important god in ancient Egypt, or became in time the most important god in ancient Egypt. He didn't start off the most important god. In fact, he started off relatively obscurely, and truth be told, Orthodox Egyptology itself, doesn't really know the true origins of Osiris. But there are some hints, there are some clues as to Osiris, what he was, and what the whole Osiris myth was about. There is a myth of Osiris which was passed down to us, I think, by Plutarch. And in this myth, we are told that Osiris was the king of Egypt, and he had a brother, his brother Seth. And Seth was jealous that Osiris was the king, and he was married to Isis.
Right.
And Seth was so jealous that he essentially went out of his way to destroy Osiris. And for his first attempt, two attempts, the first attempt was he tricked Osiris into lying in a stone box or a wooden box, and this was Osiris lay in it, and it was sealed closed very quickly by Seth and his followers. And this box was cast into the River Nile. Now, this to me, this part of the myth is symbolic of a coming flood which will drown Osiris. And eventually, the box was found by Osiris's wife Isis, embedded into an acacia tree. And that, to me, again, is symbolic of Osiris being the means of regrowth, of regeneration, of rebirth. The tree grew from Osiris. It's life reconstituting itself through the agency of Osiris.
Right.
That's the symbolism we're talking about here. And what we then find is that Seth discovers that Osiris is alive. And he sets about capturing Osiris again, and this time, to make sure that Osiris cannot come back to life, he cuts Osiris's body into 16 parts. And he takes these 16 parts and he scatters them all across the land of Egypt along the banks of the Nile. This is what we're told by Plutarch in the myth of Isis and Osiris. Mm-hmm. Now, that's all fine and well. And what happens is Isis finds these body parts of Osiris, puts them all together again, and breathes life into Osiris again, who then becomes the god of rebirth and regeneration and the afterlife. Isis couldn't find one part of the body of Osiris. And this is where the secret chamber of Osiris comes into the title of my book. Because what I believe this is all symbolism for, if we look at the most ancient text that we know that our civilization has, that's the pyramid texts of the ancient Egyptians. Now, these started appearing roughly in the 5th dynasty, in the pyramid of Unas, the pyramid of Teti. There are a few pyramids in the 5th dynasty that these texts started to appear within, on the walls within the burial chamber of these pyramids. And one of the things that these texts, a couple of important things that these texts tell us, is this: the pyramid is Osiris. The construction of the pyramids is Osiris. It says that very clearly and very plainly. The second thing they tell us, and it states very clearly and very plainly, is that Osiris is the grain. Now, there you go. You couldn't have it any clearer. The pyramids are Osiris. Osiris is the grain. Now, when I read that, a light bulb went off in my head, because I just thought, well, wait a minute. I just happened to know that there were about 19 pyramids that were built of the giant types. We're not talking about the small pyramids, the imitation pyramids, as I call them, of the 5th dynasty and beyond. But of the early Old Kingdom period up to the end of the Menkaure's reign, there are something like 19 pyramids. And 3 of those were never completed. So that leaves 16 pyramids that apparently were completed in this period. And I thought, wait a minute, 16 completed pyramids, Osiris is the pyramid, and we know there was grain in the step pyramid, lots of it. You know, Osiris is the grain. This is what the pyramid text says. Plutarch says it was cut into 16 pieces. There's 16 finished pyramids. It all just fell into place.
Yeah.
It all just fell into place. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. I wonder... Now, I don't know if you've seen this, Andrew. There is a classic figurine image of the god Osiris. You see him, he's cloaked in white. Now, to me, the Egyptologists, they say this white cloak symbolises the mummified wrappings. Whereas I'm thinking, well, no. I think the white body of Osiris symbolises the white casing stones of the pyramid. Remember, the pyramid is Osiris. That's what the pyramid texts tell us. And Osiris is the grain. His face is coloured green. And that's a symbolism for vegetation, you know, and also for rebirth and regeneration, the colour green. You know, so if you look at this classic Osiris image, he's got this peculiar crown. It's called the Atif crown, and it's unique to Osiris. And you see it with the three prongs. This Osiris crown has three prongs, and the centre prong is slightly higher than the two at the side. Now, we also find that he stands with his arms crossed, holding the royal regalia of power, the crook and flail. Mm-hmm. Now, I thought, what I did was I took that classic image, and what I did was I marked the key points on it, you know, like the three points of the Atif crown and the top end, the bottom end where his foot, the intersection of his legs, the intersection of the royal regalia where he's holding these with his hand, and the point of his heart. Mm-hmm. And I plotted these out on that image, and then I went and looked for the first 19 pyramids that the ancient Egyptians built, and I couldn't believe it. Those 16 pyramids, the points of those 16 pyramids mapped, not identically, but very, very well, the key points that I had mapped onto my matchstick Osiris image.
Right.
It was uncanny. I'm like, wow! You know, so to me, now I'm not saying here, Andrew, I'm not saying that the ancient Egyptian builders, used Osiris and that's where they placed the pyramid sites from this figurine. I'm saying it actually probably happened the other way around, because they built the pyramids first and then this image developed from the layout of the pyramids, not the other way around.
Sure.
Because obviously they would have the key consideration for the construction of the pyramids would be, access to water. Obviously the Nile was close at hand, but also access to large quantities of good limestone, granite quarries, for quarrying these large blocks and for building the pyramids, and for that would need to be high ground because, you know, they're anticipating a flood. You know, this is why you find all these pyramids, they're on the high plateaus of ancient Egypt because they were expecting a flood. So this is what I found was that these pyramids, although the key consideration was the quarries, you know, for easy access for construction materials, the 16 points I had drawn on my Osiris, classic Osiris figurine, correlated remarkably well with the first 16 pyramids that the ancient Egyptians had built. So what I think possibly happened is that maybe somehow once they had completed what I call this massive construction project, I call it Project Osiris, once this project had been completed and they had maybe mapped down where all the sites were relative to each other, someone maybe noticed, oh look, you know, if you join these up it makes this shape of, and it looks like a person, and maybe that's how the classic figure of Osiris developed.
Interesting.
Not the other way around. If you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's, I really like with the theory here. We are you're basically saying that Project Osiris now becomes one of the biggest project management undertakings of the ancient world, as opposed to just one pharaoh after another satiating this massive ego, right? And yeah. And I found that just incredibly fascinating. Another piece of the book that it was just incredible, it was like my aha moment, if you will, was when you start talking about thermodynamics and using thermodynamics as a means to build the pyramids, and then their connection to Dendera, which that just my mind exploded when I read that, because for our listeners out there familiar with the reliefs found in the Temple of Dendera, many ancient astronaut theorists will speculate that we are seeing evidence of a lost technology, i.e., these were light bulbs, and that the Egyptians had power sources, and that perhaps the pyramids served as ancient generators, and that's how they were creating this power for these light bulbs. But Scott, in your book, you say the opposite, and you say that what we're seeing here is indicative of thermodynamics being used as a means to build the pyramids. And for our listeners out there that have not read your book yet, I'd like for you to kind of walk them through the use of thermodynamics and your theory as to how these pyramids were constructed, during Project Osiris.
Okay. Well, the first thing to say, Andrew, here is that there is a legend, an ancient Egyptian legend, which states that the pyramid blocks were flown into place.
Right.
Now, you get all manner of exotic ideas being presented to try and explain what that statement refers to. And you have people, talking about levitation devices, anti-gravitational devices, sonic levitation, all manner of exotic sciences to try and explain that ancient legend, where I believe, there's a much simpler answer, and there is actually evidence to support the conclusion that I came to with the ancient Egyptians using thermodynamics. You know, Project Osiris was a massive, massive project. Obviously, it would take the civilization probably the best part of 150, maybe 200 years to complete this project.
Sure.
You know, so it was a multi-generational construction project. But also, they knew that they had limited time to construct this Project Osiris that would hopefully save their kingdom from the worst effects of this catastrophic event, which they believed was heading their way. Mm-hmm. Now, whether it did or not, or didn't, is actually material. It's what they believed was going to happen that's the important thing here. And they were basically preparing themselves as best they could for it. Now, that would probably require the development of a technology which would allow them to build these pyramids fast. If they're having to cut, if they can only move small blocks, say, of just a few pounds, uh-huh. Yeah, that's going to require infinitely more cutting and a lot more time to construct the pyramid, because smaller blocks mean a lot more cutting equals a lot more time to construct these. And they were up against the clock.
Right.
So they had to find a way of moving really heavy blocks, 2.5 ton. That's the average block inside the Great Pyramid is estimated at around 2.5 tons. Now, they had to move. They obviously averaged that with this particular thermodynamic technology, they would be able to lift these 2.5 ton blocks. Now, if you look around the Giza site, and I did this back in 2008, you will see that there are these pits. And they're not just these pits are about 20, sometimes 30 feet deep.
Right.
And it's not just one, there's two of them. It's like two deep pits side by side, dug deep into the bedrock. And they're all over Giza. And at the bottom of these pits, there are these small horizontal channels which basically connect the two pits like a kind of U shape.
Yeah.
Now, I'm thinking, what on earth would these be for? What on earth could these be for? But they're all over the Giza Plateau. And I'm thinking, what could these be? And there's been all manner of people trying to offer explanations for these. My explanation is that they basically were used to create a fire, a really, really hot, hot fire. I don't know, are you familiar, Andrew, with a Dakota fire pit?
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, a Dakota fire pit is just like what I described there. It's two holes in the ground, and you join these two deep holes with a small horizontal channel at the bottom. You connect them like a U-shape. Mm-hmm. And basically into one of these holes, you would create a fire. And what happens is the fire burns in one of these holes, and it's sucking a draft from the cold air that's going down through the other shaft along the horizontal connecting pipe. And that basically, because of that type of fire, it burns a lot hotter than a normal fire. It's not getting buffeted by the wind. And at Giza, it's obviously because it's made into the bedrock. The bedrock itself is getting really, really hot as well. So you can get extremely ferocious temperatures with these type of Dakota fire pits. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think these possibly were used as. And basically what would happen is the ancient Egyptians, just before I say this, are you familiar with the Champollion brothers, who in the early 18th or mid 18th century created the world's first hot air balloons?
Somewhat, yes.
Yeah. And you know the materials that they made that balloon out of?
No, I don't.
Well, they were made from linen and paper. Yeah, the very first balloon which took, a manned flight, was made of linen and paper, and these were the two materials that the ancient Egyptians invented. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they had the materials to make a massive hot air balloon, and essentially that they would use these Dakota fire pits to inflate these balloons, and there would be some kind of guy rope that would, once the balloon was ready to take flight, its payload would be attached, and it would be basically released to follow a guy rope up to the top of the pyramid. It would just basically float up to the pyramid, following the guy rope. That's, to me, would explain this legend. The pyramid stones were flown into place.
Right.
Very, very easily.
Excuse me.
A hot air, a spherical hot air balloon with a diameter of 125 feet and can carry, including itself, the weight of the actual balloon and the ropes and so forth, can carry about 5 tons, just over 5 tons. Wow. That's two pyramid blocks. I've done the calculations for this, and it works out. So you could have, various stations. You could probably have easily four stations per side of the pyramid, so that's 16, that's 32 blocks. It would probably take, inflating the balloon to, it going back up the pyramid. You could probably, have blocks being raised, about 3 minutes, mm-hmm. A 3 minute cycle, because you wouldn't just have one balloon, you'd have a cycle of balloons, as one is rising up the pyramid, another one would be coming down,
right.
One would be being inflated, so you would have this cycle of balloons, never ending cycle, just constantly on the go. And obviously, with it being so hot in Egypt, if you dyed the material black,
right.
It would absorb the solar energy from the sun and keep it, hotter inside for longer. So that is essentially the basic theory. Now, there are obviously some pieces of evidence to support that, and one obviously is the Dakota fire pits around Giza. These things are all over the Giza site. And there are, as you touched on at the beginning of the piece, Andrew, there are the images at the Temple of Dendera, which some theorists speculate are images of light bulbs.
Right.
Whereas if we actually study the images and with an Egyptological perspective, you have Horus there, who is the god of the sky, and you have I think it's Amenhotep, who is the goddess of air, and there's text written at the side of these images which look like hot air balloons lying on the side being inflated. They're not light bulbs. There's a snake in them, and that's a goddess of the air,
right?
Yeah, inside these balloons, and probably symbolizes hot air inside these balloons, or what look like balloons being inflated, you know. So, and beside these balloons, you have this text which talk about the sky carriers, you know. So, and also in another part of the Temple of Dendera, you see the very same shapes, these balloon-type shapes, but they're no longer horizontal lying on the ground. They're actually now vertical, they're upright. And underneath them, my goodness, it looks like there's a basket, or like they're carrying stones.
Right.
So, yeah, it may seem a bit out there. I mean, I do not deny that this theory is maybe just a bit out there. But, you know, the calculations have been done. You know, there's some evidence there to support the idea. You know, Discovery Channel, have a go, see if it can be done.
Yeah, run it through Mythbusters.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know what? I think in terms of the overall theory, the basis of the theory, it makes so much sense. And for our listeners right now, I would strongly encourage you to hop on Google and query for the Dendera light bulbs, but then also query for a hot air balloon being inflated. And if you put these images side by side, which is what Scott has done in his book, the resemblance is uncanny, and it is very difficult to argue against it. And then, just like you said, Scott, that's not a singular existence at Dendera. We do see other relief carvings that display these balloons vertically, yeah, in flight, pulling what does appear to be the blocks. Yeah. And if you find the evidence at the Giza Plateau, I mean, I read that, and like I said, my mind exploded, and that was one of my biggest aha moments while reading your book. And it got me very, very fired up and excited, and I feel like I read this connection. At the same time, it made me a bit upset and a bit saddened that here we find, again, going back to the beginning of our conversation, here we find incredible evidence that could actually explain the way these monuments were built, as opposed to just the orthodox view of slave labor. But it's ignored. It's just, yeah, this is the proverbial baby thrown out with the bathwater, and how sad is that? That we just have the uniformitarian chokehold on our historical record, and we're just being spoon-fed this narrative of, nope, here's what happened, and, eat your broccoli. It's very unfortunate, but for our listeners, I would strongly encourage you all to pick up a copy of Scott's The Secret Chamber of Osiris. You will not be disappointed. One of my favorite books that I've read in a long time. Scott, we only have a few minutes left today, so what is next for Scott Crichton? You're working on another book right now. Anything you want to share with our listeners to let them know of all things happening in your world?
Yeah. Well, as you said, Andrew, there's an awful lot more in the Secret Chamber of Osiris than we've discussed on the program tonight. What I would say is my next book is it's called The Great Pyramid Hoax. And it basically is a book documenting the evidence of a massive fraud having taken place in the Great Pyramid by the chap we spoke briefly about earlier, Colonel Howard Vyse, in 1837. There's been a lot of speculation over the years about whether this chap discovered these images within these hidden chambers, or whether he placed them there himself.
Right.
Well, my next book blows the lid, if that's one way of putting it, and presents a ton of evidence, piece after piece after piece of evidence. This is new evidence. We're not talking about the stuff that's been presented before by Zechariah Sitchin, which has been largely criticised and debunked in large parts. Not all, but in large parts it's been debunked, and also some of the things that Alan Alford has stated. So it's none of that evidence. We're talking about new evidence here that's been uncovered just in the last 18 months or 2 years or so, which just blows the lid on the whole Colonel Howard Weiss so-called discovery of these marks. Now, these marks are important, Andrew, because they're the only marks which Egyptologists use to claim this building does belong to Khufu,
right,
and was built in 2550 BC. That's all they have, and this book, this, the Great Pyramid Hoax, blows the lid on that piece of evidence.
I can't wait, and we can expect that, is that later this year, first part of 2017, when can we expect
it? Yeah, well, in our traditions, Bear and Company, I think it's scheduled probably either for the end of December this year, or certainly by no later than January 2017.
Perfect, good. Well, we can't wait for that, and I hope that we can get you back on the program to discuss that in greater detail as we get closer to a release. Scott, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. We really appreciate you taking the time to speak for our listeners and share some of your theories and concepts and research with our group. So we really appreciate you being here today. Thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Andrew. You're a great host, and I absolutely won't have any hesitation in coming back again in the future to discuss some other things.
Awesome. Thank you. I appreciate that. That's very kind. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's episode. I really hope that you enjoyed the conversation between myself and Scott. Make sure that you guys hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode or an article from your friends here at Lost Origins. And make sure that you guys tune in next week. Next week, we're going to be chatting with Dr. Tudor Parfit about his work surrounding the Lost Tribes of Israel. So if you have not had the chance to dig into that mystery, holy cow, buckle up. Your mind is about to be blown. This guy's research is fascinating. His story is incredible. You do not want to miss that episode. So I'm your host, Andrew, and until next time on Lost Origins, continue to question everything.